How Curious, sponsored by Oklahoma City Community Foundation.
People come to the Oklahoma City Community Foundation because they care about this community. They want a bright future for this region. And they come to the Oklahoma City Community Foundation because they know we can help make that happen.
Together, we can build a stronger, more supportive community for everyone. If you want to make a difference, join us. Your Oklahoma City Community Foundation will help you make it happen.
Hello, welcome to KGOU's How Curious. I'm Rachel Hopkin. At the start of a 1954 short film titled Movie Stunt Pilot, a small Stearman biplane is flying what seems to be perilously low. Incredibly, it then breezes through the huge open doors of a hangar, then shoots safely out the other side, all watched on by a film crew. The crew's director picks up a radio and speaks to the man in the plane.
Paul! Anything wrong?
Perfect. Sensational.
The happy director is Otto Lang, and the astonishing pilot is named Paul Mantz. According to the tagline of a biography written about Mantz, he was a showman, daredevil, hero, rogue, who blazed a legend in the skies. And although he was born and lived most of his life in California, he's part of a unique chapter of Oklahoma history, too.
Paul Mantz is one of those fascinating figures that really is a product of the 20th century.
I spoke with Ted Hutter from Seattle's Museum of Flight via Zoom.
He was just extremely skilled aerobatic pilot. And that was his great skill in starting out in Hollywood pictures, is that in the 1920s and 1930s, there were an enormous amount of aviation-related feature films. It's hard to even imagine today because aviation just is part of everybody's life. And it's hard to think of an event that would really get the headlines, you know, except a disaster. But at that period, it was big news virtually all the time. It was all about setting speed records, setting altitude records. It was about air racing. It was about stunt flying. It was about anything to do with aviation was part of the American culture at that time. So the people that excelled in it were famous. In Paul Mantz's case, he became part of the Hollywood celebrity set.
I asked Ted what kind of aviation stunts we might be talking about.
The studios would pay pilots pretty good rates to do incredible stunts on films. And they're usually entailed crashes of some kind, you know, flying into a building, flying under bridges or through buildings, jumping out of airplanes, airplanes spinning into the ground with the pilot having to bail out at a certain altitude so he wouldn't go in with it.
People think of me as a stunt pilot.
Paul Mantz's words are here read by an actor.
I'm supposed to be a devil-may-care aviator in helmet and goggles, white scarf whipping back, roaring under bridges, flying through open hangars, deliberately crashing planes into splinters, driving through narrow canyons in search of more and more thrills. I've done all that, sure. But I am not a stunt pilot. I'm a precision flyer.
So he thought of himself as a precision flyer rather than a stunt pilot. As he grew in experience, he also began to direct flight scenes and became very good at it. In addition, he had marked entrepreneurial flair. He set up a business which offered aircraft, pilots, standard rates and insurance all in one go to Hollywood studios.
He became known as the person to go to when you wanted aerial scenes in your picture, because they knew that he was safe and they knew that they could get the best shot. So he created a business that endured for decades.
And the business was flexible enough to adapt when the movie world fell on lean times.
He still had the planes to stay in business, and they were doing, you know, crop dusting, air taxi service. They also did mercy flights, air ambulance flights. There's one incredible story where some Navy divers had the bends, you know, coming from a dive. They picked up the diver and had to fly him to a decompression chamber. But The thing is, if you're suffering from decompression, the last thing you want to do is fly in an airplane, go even higher. So he is literally skimming the surface of the water for a couple hundred miles up the California coast to transport him as fast as possible, but at almost, sea level.
So on the one hand, we have Paul Mantz, precision pilot extraordinaire and entrepreneur. And on the other, we have a specific location in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I've got to wear my badge.
I'm at Stillwater Regional Airport with aviator and scholar Tom Weichel.
But we'll go through this gate right here.
Tom has written about Paul Mantz, and he explained to me how it comes down to a moment in history back in 1945, when this place was still known as Searcy Field.
As the war was drawing down, the U.S. government had a problem on its hands in terms of disposing of former military aircraft. So they had thousands. And, some of them they gave away, some of them they gave to other countries. Some were used as trainers. But a bigger problem were the bombers and the fighters, because they were really military aircraft. They were combat aircraft. And so many of those aircraft were stored in, there were eight fields around the country. Oklahoma actually had three, one in Clinton Sherman, one in Altus, and then one in Stillwater, which was Searcy Field.
The government decided they would make a special case of Searcy Field and the planes stored there compared with the other seven sites.
At some of the other airfields, they, meaning the government, broke up the airplanes. They would slice them up, and then they would melt the aluminum, and they would recycle the plexiglass and other aircraft parts. But in Stillwater, they decided to try an experiment. They hadn't really done this before. They decided to make the aircraft available for purchase by a corporation or a private individual. So this was the first of its kind. They called it a field sale of these surplus aircraft. So in here in Stillwater, there were 475 combat aircraft of all types stored on the field.
The government had paid well over $100 million for the planes.
They made the purchases by competitive bidding. And they did receive several bids for the aircraft in Searcy, but the winning bid was about $55,000. And in fact, it was only a few hundred dollars more than the second place bid. And the man that bought the aircraft
was, of course, Paul Mantz, as I'm sure you've guessed.
Mantz tried to convince the movie studios that they should make a purchase. I mean, I don't think he was really intending to buy them himself. But when they didn't, that's when he acted and made the purchase himself.
Apparently, Mantz was convinced that there would be a slew of films about the war, and they'd be needing to feature appropriate aircraft scenes. But even Mantz would have been hard-pushed to make use of 475 planes. Still, he had plans.
He kept 12 of them, and he sold the remaining aircraft to a partnership that included himself and two businessmen from Dallas. And this scrap group that he put together that purchased the aircraft basically scrapped all the aircraft. So they cut up the airframes, they disassembled the instruments, they removed engines, they removed plexiglass, and they sold all of this material as scrap. For cash, they got about $160,000 for the aluminum, about $100,000 for the plexiglass. And what's interesting, they sold oxygen regulators that they removed from the aircraft back to the Army Air Forces for $75 each. So they didn't, the Army Air Forces never thought about the fact that there was some valuable things associated with the aircraft. And Mantz actually made a claim that he made his money back just on the aviation fuel that was still on the wings of the aircraft.
We'll start on this. This is actually a tail wheel from a P-40 that was taken apart here.
Tim Fitzgerald is now a flight line supervisor at Stillwater Regional Airport, but he grew up near the runway here and has been collecting parts of those old aeroplanes since he was a kid.
This is Curtiss Aeroplane. And this is a serial number. This is the part number, manufacturing. I don't know if it has a date on it. Yeah, I'm looking at it upside down. But anyway, that's actually a tail wheel for a P-40, what they call a Warhawk, or it's a single-engine fighter. That was before the P-51. And you can take all the pictures you want.
I did take pictures, as Tim showed me numerous artifacts which were discarded in the scrapping process. And you can see some of them at this episode's webpage. Just search for KGOU and How Curious. But what of the 12 planes that Mantz kept? Ted Hutter told me that four of them became his favorites.
And three of them were P-51 fighters, and one of them was a B-25 bomber. So The P-51s he used to fly in air races, and he had one of them modified for with long-range fuel tanks in the wings, which was totally new for a P-51. It was a recipe for success and for these, what they're called, the Bendix air races.
These were prestigious transcontinental speed competitions which ran from the 1930s to the 60s.
He won three of them in a row after World War II. He was the only person that ever did something like that.
Mantz got even more creative with that B-25, according to Tom Weichel.
He had it modified by putting in a bathroom. He had a swivel chair put in behind where the bombardier sat, and he used it for filming, and he would sit in the swivel chair and direct the filming from that chair. And this plane was called Smasher, named for his dad, who was a heavy drinker. And what's interesting is Mantz flew Smasher over Stillwater and all the aircraft that had been stored here in 1946 for the 1947 Academy Award-winning movie, The Best Years of Our Lives. And there's a scene where in that movie where there are three former service members. There's a guy from the Navy, a guy from, I believe, the Marine Corps, and an Army guy, and they're sitting in the nose, and they flew over all the aircraft.
I found the film on YouTube and watched the scene in question.
Hey, that must be the new airport.
Yeah, we're turning into it now. Holy smoke.
I never knew there were so many planes.
And they're junking them.
No. What?
Boy, oh boy. But we could have done with those in 43.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Some of them look brand new, from the factory to the scrap heap.
It's quite amazing to see. There are planes everywhere, laid out all higgledy-piggledy. By the way, I asked Tom, but he told me he thought the actual planes at Searcy Field were all pretty well used, not new, as one of the characters in the film comments. Smasher was used in numerous movies after that, right up to Catch 22 in 1970. But by then, Paul Mantz had been dead for 5 years. He was tragically killed in an accident whilst flying a plane, not one of the ones from Searcy Field, during the making of a James Stewart picture called The Flight of the Phoenix. I asked Tom Weichel if any of the Searcy Field planes were still around today.
Yes, the two P-51s that were used in the Bendix races, one of them was renamed, it was called Blaze of Glory, it was renamed Excalibur III. It actually hangs at the Smithsonian Institute. There, the other P-51 is at a museum in Florida.
Tom mentioned one or two other planes held by private individuals or corporations.
But what was really remarkable to me, I had no idea that one of the B-24 bombers that Mantz purchased and flew for quite a long time is now in the Commemorative Air Force. And it's called Diamond Lil.
The Commemorative Air Force is a non-profit that preserves and flies old military aircraft. Thanks to Tom Weichel and all the contributors to this episode, including reader James Briggs. How Curious is a KGOU public radio production. The managing editor is Logan Layden. David Gray composed our theme music, and I'm Rachel Hopkin. As ever, if you have an idea for a future episode, we'd love to hear about it. So drop us a line at curious@kgou.org.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.